Welcome everybody to the Capital Markets Day for Workspace 2017, and also welcome to Fleet Street if you haven't been here before. I know some of you have done. Fleet Street we bought back in November 2014, spent a little bit of money on the reception area and some of the meeting rooms in 2016, but actually the building's been a really good success for us since we bought it, so an opportunity for you to see that as well. And actually, I think Fleet Street is quite an exciting and interesting location. And just following on the locational theme, a lot of you know for many, many years, probably since the pyramids were built actually, location, location, location has always been the backdrop to anything real estate, residential or commercial, location, location, location. You've sat next to us boring people at dinner parties and all we've gone on about is location, location, location. And it was probably about 18 months ago in a presentation like this where I whacked up a slide putting location, location, technology, just to try and bring out that technology piece because we felt it was so important. I was pleasantly surprised and somewhat worried how much pickup it got. Some of you guys certainly quoted it back. Certainly the media locked onto it. But fortunately for me, I didn't need to worry because pretty much from that moment onwards, every single conference that I was invited to speak at or just saw the agenda, every single real estate article in a commercial property magazine or a newspaper was talking about new ways of working, new space design, the way customers are using space differently, and the fact that technology was continuing to shape the future of real estate. So my view actually is location, location technology is probably old news already, and actually location space technology is what we should be talking about. Of course, location is absolutely critical. It's paramount for when an occupier is choosing a building. But if you don't have the right internal physical environment, you don't have the right internal virtual environment, then you won't be keeping your occupiers. And that's where we're really coming from today. That's the theme of what this afternoon is all about. Not the gimmicky side of technology, but how the technology revolution has really, really eaten into the real estate sector as a whole, to the modern day customer, and of course, as we think, to the future. So that's really setting the scene for what we're going to talk about today. Just looking at the agenda, I'm just going to introduce the speakers and then step away and leave some of the other management team to talk. Firstly, I'm going to hand you over to Michael Davis, who's very kindly joined us from JLL. Michael heads up London Unlimited's division of JLL. London Unlimited provide strategic and transactional advice to landlords in all sectors of the market, as well as act for many media and technology companies across the capital. They focus on the emerging areas of Greater London and they see their advice as very much fit for the future. So Michael will talk about the impact of innovation in real estate and he is clearly very well qualified to do so. Next, we'll hand over to Chris Peroni, many of you know, our operations director, along with James Friedenthal, some of you who won't know, who heads up our corporate development. And they're both going to look at the importance of a technology actually to us as a business. So all about technology and workspace, the importance to our customers and also the importance to us as a business. Then, slight change of gear. Angus will come up, who also you know, development director, to join Chris. Still very much on innovation and the future, but talking more around from cradle to grave, the process, the knowledge and the thinking that goes behind any decisions we make to bring new space to the market. So filtering some of the things that we talked about earlier on, but taking you right the way through the journey. And I'm very keen that you understand how everybody works together seamlessly at Workspace, how we manage, control and use our data and knowledge to make those decisions. And also importantly, the fact that we're not reliant on, obviously Michael, case in point, but we're not reliant on third-party consultants to tell us what's going on out in the market demand supply-wise. We're not reliant on anyone telling us what we should be doing with our buildings. And ultimately, we're not reliant on anyone to actually let the space for us. We do all of that ourselves. So hopefully that sets the scene for today. I'm going to hand over to Michael. I'll come back a little bit later on, but Michael.
So good afternoon, everybody. Jamie actually mentioned a lot of the market-facing thing that the team, the kind of activities that the team undertakes. But actually, another role that we do that isn't widely known is we're responsible for looking at the way that an organisation like JLL needs to innovate as well. So when I go through the slides, part of it is obviously market-facing and certainly the playback and the responses we get from our client base, but half of it is also the kind of strategy and the thoughts that an organisation like JLL is looking at engaging in as well. So I should add that this is a very condensed, because we didn't have 3 hours, version of our 86-page report that we put together painstakingly at the tail end of last year. So again, if there are any questions after the event, please let me know. For start with a basic equation, we believe that technology times organisations reorganise basically means dramatic real estate change. And this isn't just a technology thing, it's also a generational thing as well. We're seeing that largely as a result of the last recession, occupiers have sought to revisit their portfolios, look at the way they occupy their space, both on a just simple things like desking, but also on a strategic perspective as well. Partly cost saving, but also fundamentally the way that they're doing their business has changed and people are demanding new things from their workplace. So looking at what we call the digital ecosystem, there are four kind of key points here to take away. Firstly is the exponential advances in computational power. Essentially, you can do everything from your phone, more or less. I mean, I have a mobile office. I don't have a permanent desk. I use my tablet to do 90% of my work with a laptop if I need to do anything a little bit more complex. The ubiquitous connectivity point. We're seeing London, but also abroad, a number of developments take a leap forward over other developments because they can offer things like on-site data centre provision, also places like the Olympic Park and even the old BBC campus in White City are doing very, very well in terms of their attraction of not just commercial tenants, but also residential tenants because they have things like on-site energy provision, a data centre, also the best fibre in each of their particular markets. And that's something that now, with things like WideScore in particular, which is a globally acknowledged scoring matrix for not just the speed of the internet connection, but also the resilience and also the speed at which a tenant can move into the space and have it connected. All of these things, occupiers are now getting much more sophisticated in the way that they view connectivity. The Internet of Things is a fascinating point because originally, and it's still true to say that it's very much been led by the retail sector, but when you think about it, if you go to a shopping centre like Meadow Hall, for example, which is owned by British Land, they have monitoring points everywhere that play back to the landlord, footfall, spend patterns, even down to if you register, down to the kind of the personal data of that particular party. Well, that means that the landlord can interpret all of that data and play it back and make much more responsive decisions. Could be elementary things like, well, what rent do we charge, or should we move one tenant from one place to another? But it could be interpreted for much more sophisticated levels of data collection. The next thing that we're now engaged with a lot of clients is how do we take that and apply it to the commercial sector? Because certainly, as far as I can see, in a business like Workspace, where there's lots of potential change or usage differences in different centres, you could use that data quite intelligently. And then lastly, in terms of the data revolution, it's largely connected to the Internet of Things, but ultimately, this is not going to go away. Exponential amounts of data means that people have to be able to harness that data in every walk of life. People talk about the digital sector. Every sector is the digital sector, as far as we're concerned. So what does this mean? Actually, looking at the way that organisations have reorganised themselves, it's about vertical stacks. So it's not necessarily, I mean, funny enough, I was with a large media agency this morning who everybody would have considered them 5 years ago to be digital and advertising. Now they are massively moving into the field of innovation, working with anything from automotive companies through to sports people, through to real estate companies, as well as how they can disrupt their marketplace. The contingent workforce is, again, fascinating. While it's sort of very much on our minds at the moment is, most work now is done in project teams for finite periods of time to solve problems. What it means is that people aren't at their desks in the same place for 10 years at a time. In fact, they're probably there for about 6 months at a time. So actually, can the occupational model be completely revisited, have a core model of workforce of 30% of the full-time employees and everybody else is hired on a part-time basis? That is changing the way that people are viewing their real estate, because that, coupled with the rise of the machine, means that you get a leaner future, that ultimately corporates could have 30% of their footprint, and this is what we're predicting over the next 5 to 7 years, corporates will ultimately downsize, and 30% of their footprint will be flexible space, because if you remember back to the recession of 2008-2009, where there was lots of grey space released to the market, and it was a real headache because lots of corporates were hemorrhaging cash in the shortfall, actually taking flexible space means that you have a great deal of, as it would suggest, flexibility, whether the market explodes or whether the market goes downwards. And then looking lastly at the digital demographic side of things is that actually the types of people doing the jobs now have completely changed. So, for example, JLL are slowly moving away from recruiting the kind of institutional, we've been to Reading University, we've been to Oxford Brookes, and actually recruiting people who are more along the lines of data analysts, because that's the kind of response that our clients are asking us to undertake. So looking at the four key areas of how it actually impacts the world of real estate, firstly, technology and real estate, they're colliding, so what does that actually mean to the market? Data-defined real estate, so that's, again, taking the playback of data a little bit further. Workplace as a service, it's pretty obvious given why we're here today, and also connectivity being the fourth utility. So if you look at all firms, they all face competition. They all have pressure in which to innovate, and the role of the workplace is being fundamentally challenged. Now, that can mean physically. So we're seeing a lot of demand from people looking to simple things like connect between floors with vertical connectivity with interconnecting staircases. But fundamentally, it's putting pressures on rental profile and what does it mean to be in a large city like central London. So if you go to Germany, for example, you've got effectively five major cities there where they all form a slightly different, they occupy a slightly different point in the German economy. So you go to Berlin, it's more tech. If you go to Munich, it's a bit more bioscience, for example, and manufacturing. Whereas London is a melting pot for lots of different sectors. So as the price kind of paradigm is squeezed and pushed with 100 plus rents in Mayfair, for example, and Prime West End, the whole point of technology is challenging the way that people use their office. Do you need to be in the office 5 days a week? I would argue no. Do you need to be in front of your team 5 days a week? I would argue no, but you need to be there present at some point in time. So utilising that ultimately means you can consolidate and make your portfolio much, much more flexible. Looking at the types of space, we are getting probably 20% of the demand over the course of this year so far has been for space that is not office space, which is fascinating considering our marketplace covers the patch that I cover in terms of the emerging London, but also core city and West End. It's people saying, I need things with 5 metre floor to ceiling height. I need studio space. I need industrial space. They're all what you would call normal companies, but they're all diversifying their business model, which is putting a massive strain on the built environment. And actually the challenge is how do developers cope with that going forward, because we think it's going to carry on in the same vein. And then lastly, tech-enabled workplaces. The point I was making earlier on about things like the Olympic Park and White City is that there's a natural friction point at the moment, because developers by rights have to go through the planning process, have to build the building, and on average that takes 3 to 4 years. Well, the occupier mindset is very much along the lines of, well, I can put something into my house, I can buy it from Maplin and put in a responsive a home management system. Why can't I do it in my office? Now, I can assure you there are things like that out there in the world. Siemens have got the Crystal, which they've fitted a whole building out in the same kind of vein. But at the moment, the two worlds don't mesh together. And that's something that we think has to change over the next 3 to 5 years, because occupiers will get frustrated. So in terms of data-defined real estate, I won't spend too much on this. It's very much playing back the point I was making before about using data in an intelligent way. If you had data monitoring points around your whole building, for example, as we've got in our headquarters in Warwick Street, it means you can track footfall, energy usage, meeting rooms that are under or over occupied, which means you ultimately can make a change in those, make your building more efficient, saves you money, but also gives the end user a much more pleasant experience. And one of our predictions that came out of this research after surveying about 100 companies was that the personalisation point about office space is the number one thing that's on an occupier's agenda going forward. Probably the best analogy to use is your car. If you buy a reasonable car these days, you know, you can get into it and you can turn the key. If you're lucky, the seat might adjust. You know, it'll remember temperature, blah, blah, blah. You can set it for you or for the other person that perhaps drives your car. I'm thinking of BMWs here. that's what people are going to want from their desk space and their meeting room space. And there's technology out there which will allow that. And so we think it's something that has to be delivered going forward. In terms of adaptive design, just very quickly, that's very much about the flexibility in the workplace. So again, using the data intelligently. And then the main point here is workplace as a service. The first point here is probably the most important as far as we're concerned, is experience-led workplaces. It pains me to use Google as an example because I think it's been overplayed, and equally we get a lot of jip from our Occupy clients about the whole beanbags and, you know, slides and what have you, which are a bit passé now. But ultimately it's about impact, and what we're getting certainly from Procter & Gamble through to even people like Deloitte are saying our main office is a shop window for our clients, whether they're new clients or existing clients. And it's important that as soon as they cross the threshold into the space, they effectively become so engaged that they're almost brand advocates, and they'll talk to other people about it, which, whether it's direct or indirect, perhaps generates business for them. And we've got the same thing that we're trying to do at Warwick Street. And it's the same across every workplace. It's not some guy with a big fat budget saying, I want to spend more and have the best space. It's actually about trying to create something that attracts and retains talent, and also hopefully attracts and retains revenue. And then the growth of co-working and flex space. You guys are no doubt as well informed as I am. What's quite interesting is that last year in central London, over 10% of the total space acquired in central London was of the co-working sector. And that starts with one man and his dog in the middle of Hackney taking 5,000 square feet through to guys like you taking larger chunks of space and bringing other developments to the market. The fundamental thing is that, going back to my point earlier on about the corporate agenda and the hub and spoke model, perhaps of 30% being flexible or liquid space, we very much believe that that's something is going to become, well, it's here to stay as far as we're concerned. But it's here to stay as long as those brands stay relevant and keep offering something new to the consumer, because they're as fickle, frankly, as we are when we change the wallpaper at home. And then connectivity, the fourth utility. Again, not to dwell too much, but the importance of this is not to be overlooked. Just as you would get annoyed if you sign up to your Virgin Media contract at home and it takes you know, more than a month to get it signed up if you're lucky, it's the same thing for occupiers. And going back to the wide score matrix that I was telling you about earlier on, there are other companies that do wireless daisy chaining of internet, which means you can get broadband speed started up in the next 24-36 hours after moving in. A lot of occupiers now, certainly at the smaller end of the market, they actively will shun buildings because they don't have an adequate provision. And certainly there are a number of big regeneration projects in central London, things like Canada Water, Old Oak Common, the Olympic Park, for example. They are all starting with very much a blank canvas and saying, okay, well, we know this is where the market's going to go. We are going to, by default, put in things like the energy centre, the data centre. We are going to make sure that we have the best connectivity, bar none, and spending the money for the first time on the infrastructure first before the real estate itself. So just to sum up, we actually have constructed a roadmap to 2030. I should really add that we did this piece of research 15 years ago and made a series of predictions about what we thought would come true. And largely, all of our points around the importance of the mobile phone and mobile working have come true. So we're hoping that certainly at least 30 to 50% of what's on the screen will come true. But certainly the corporate point about streamlining their portfolios, I think we're already starting to see that anyway. Technology becoming far more embedded into workplaces. Again, there's no reason why it shouldn't happen. 30% of corporate portfolios, that's a bold claim, but I think it's certainly been somewhere between 20 and 30%. And then the optimal connectivity will become a key competitive advantage. I think you could argue quite rightly sat here today that if you don't do it, you would be behind your competitors in the next couple of years. And then this is really just a timeline. What's quite interesting as far as we're concerned, the sectors that are leading the way in terms of the evolution of technology in the environment are probably unsurprisingly residential and also hotels. Why is that? Largely because they're both B2C, but fundamentally they both rely on quite rapid turnovers and productivity, which is not dissimilar to how Workspace operates. The people who will struggle with this are the institutional landlords, who very much see themselves at the top end of the market doing deals for 100,000 square feet. They will be the people who probably will see this last and possibly suffer the most when the change really hits home. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks, Michael. And good afternoon. James and I are just going to focus on technology. We're going to look at why we think it's important. And then we're going to look at it in two different ways. The technology that we provide for our customers, why are we doing it and what are we doing? And then James is going to look at the technology that we're developing for ourselves and how we're using that to the benefit of the company. So why is technology so important? There's a sort of virtuous circle here. The more we provide our customers with technology, the more they use it. And the more we then learn about their use, sometimes via our own technology, and therefore the better we get at providing for their needs, ultimately making our buildings, hopefully, much more attractive for our customer base. Just a quick reminder of our customers, a broad spread of sectors, we are not tech-focused. In fact, tech as a sector gives us a very small proportion of our rental income. But like all of us, all of our customers are using technology more and more. So our strategy, and many of you will have seen this diagram on a number of occasions, is to focus on technology as it affects our properties, making them attractive to our customers, as it affects our understanding of our customers, and also our brand. We want technology to be integral to our brand offering. So let's look now at how we are providing a technology platform for our customers. And our objective is to make connectivity a reason to come to us. That's what we're trying to do. Now, I know I've got Italian blood in me, and honestly, I really do like spaghetti, but even I draw the line somewhere. And what you see on the left is one of our comms rooms in 2010. Okay? Multiple suppliers fighting for space, borrowing each other's equipment, more like a combat room than a comms room. And it was at about the point we were seriously considering employing people just to sit full-time in the comms rooms that we realised we really had to step in and start to take charge. And at that point, we formed a relationship with a single technology supplier, XL Communications. And this is how we used to do things. Each business centre had multiple providers, and each provider had their own separate contract with whoever was supplying that customer. There was no backup between the business centre and the exchange. If your Virgin line goes down, BT aren't going to help you, okay? And you're completely dependent on Openreach between the exchange and the internet. And we were learning from our customers that people who had problems with Openreach were having serious problems because it could take 3 or 4 days, sometimes weeks, to resolve those problems. You can't run a business like that. This is our network today. There's a number of things to note. The business centres all have multiple links, both to each other and to exchanges. We also have links to data centres, the core nodes there. And those core nodes, data centres, are linked to each other. So it's a proper network with multiple backup channels. And you might think, OK, this is a nice diagram. How does Workspace actually influence what's going on there? Well, we at XL, our partners, own everything in red. Obviously, the business centres. The hashed lines are leased lines that we lease from Openreach solely for our use. We don't share them with anyone, so we have full control over what goes on those leased lines. The fixed lines are lines that we own and manage. That's dark fibre that's just for us. And so we're able to link all of our business centres to each other and to exchanges. These lines are what's lovingly called as air fibre, which you might know more about, laser links. So we're linking our buildings through dark fibre and air fibre, and we're linking through to exchanges. And in the exchanges, we have our own switching. So we're in charge of the switching that goes on within our lines, and also to the core nodes, where we have our own switching and our own equipment in those data centres. So for our customers, their access to the internet is solely through equipment that we own and manage, with multiple backup routes in the event of any failure. So any one building has lots of different ways of connecting to the internet. So effectively, our network is a proper network. And within that network, we've got cybersecurity systems that are extremely advanced. So we've got servers in the internet that are looking for incoming attacks. And we've got equipment within the network that's negating the impact of incoming attacks. Now, there are many types of cyber attacks, and many of them are happening continuously. There are specific types where people, they're called denial of service attacks, where people go at servers to try and reduce them. And we're able to spot those. We get about 14 a month of those. And we're managing those completely as part of the management of our network. So our customers effectively are getting a service with complete backup to all our buildings, a consistent business-grade digital platform, network resilience and advanced cybersecurity, all of which is managed by us and our partners. And as our customers use our networks, it's helping us to understand their digital demand. So at Metalbox, for example, typically will consume about 2 terabytes of data a day. Well, what's that? Well, that's equivalent to about 1,700 homes. So an acre of metal box is about 115 acres of a residential site. It's a lot of data. But it's only about 10% of the data capacity of the network. So there's plenty of room for more growth there. And we can also see how the data is being consumed. And we can monitor the different ways in which data is being used. And it won't, you know, we're picking up the obvious trends about there's a quite a swift shift now from unencrypted to encrypted data. And we can also look at other things as well when we're looking at digital demand. The number of connected devices. This has quite a serious implications for us. 45% of connectivity is coming from mobile devices. 2/3 of these are Apple. We can see what devices people are using. Almost 1/4 of the storage is for cloud, and about 1/2 of that is going to Dropbox. Now, the key point here is that we're now able to monitor and manage the demand in real time. The consequence of that is that we are having to continuously upgrade our infrastructure, from the data capacity, the pipes and the switching, to the Wi-Fi, which we're rolling out across the business centres, which I'll come back to. And a good example is Metalbox. We think it was the first 10 gigabyte circuit in a London commercial multi-let building. It now has gigabyte Wi-Fi. And this building has a WiredScore Platinum rated. There are only a handful of buildings in London with a WiredScore Platinum, including the Shard, including the Broadcast Centre in Wood Lane. And the 10 gigabyte pipes are the largest available in the market today. And only a few years ago, we would routinely be installing 100 megabyte pipes into our new buildings. In fact, those of you who know Canalot and can remember when we brought that to the market, routinely 100 megabyte pipe. It wasn't very long afterwards we had to upgrade that to 10 gigabytes. And until an even larger pipe comes out, we'll be having to put multiple 10 gigabyte pipes into our buildings as and when demand requires. And the rapid growth of mobile devices accessing our networks is significantly increasing demand for Wi-Fi at our centres. The WiredScore Platinum is a couple of key points here. It's only given to the building owners. And it relates to the digital infrastructure, not the services, the infrastructure. Oops, sorry. And it's quite specific and rigorous. We have to go through a lot of work to get these accreditations. And here are just some of the examples. We need comms rooms on each floor. The intakes and risers have to meet quite precise specifications. The cables have to be protected. And we have to have backup, fibre on the rooftops, air fibre on the rooftops, and battery backup as well. They conduct on-site inspections, and they even read all our wayleave agreements. So it's not easy to get this accreditation. And the nice thing for us is that as standards develop going forward, as owners, we're able to respond immediately. So it helps us future-proof our buildings. We don't have to talk to managing agents. We don't have to persuade other landlords that we'd like to do things to meet the next Wired Score standard. And we're really pleased, actually, that Mozilla, who run the global Firefox browser based at Metalbox, run all of their business on the technology platform that we provide. So it's quite a pat on the back for the technology that we do. Now, a good example of why it's so important to be in full control of the technology is Wi-Fi. And Wi-Fi runs on three frequencies. This is what happens when 100 businesses at Pillbox all decide to install their own Wi-Fi. Okay? They just contend and they knock each other out. And we get calls saying your digital platform doesn't work. It does work. It's the fact that you've got 100 Wi-Fi networks all fighting for three frequencies. So again, we had to step in and take charge. And we actually helped develop a brand new ErrorHive system, which has access points managed by a sophisticated software that ensures that all customers can access the Wi-Fi without being thrown out by another trying to access the same frequency. And what's more, because we provide the Wi-Fi across all of our network, we can effectively provide the Wi-Fi, sorry, because we provide the network, we can effectively provide the Wi-Fi across all of our business centres. So if you've got a unit in Pillbox and you happen to be in Metalbox, you just go on the Wi-Fi as you would back in your own unit. So we think it's Wi-Fi, but it's Wi-Fi across all of our business centres. So our connectivity really is a key focus for us because we genuinely need the connectivity to be a reason for customers to come to us. So I hope that gives you a good feel for why we're doing and how we're providing technology to our customers. And James is now going to talk about the technology which we are developing for ourselves to run our own business.
Thanks, Chris. So how we use technology to find out more about our customers, offer them new services, and develop our business. But fundamentally, how do we stay at the top of our game? How do we stay relevant? And how do we keep developing that the technology pillar of our business strategy regarding our brand? So you may not be familiar with me, but hopefully many of you will be familiar with the Metalbox. This is a property that we redesigned, refurbished, and repositioned to create a landmark business centre at Bankside. So we've already heard about the in-ground fibre coming into the building, the security that's there, the air fibre on the roof, which allows our customers, wherever they happen to be in their units, playing table tennis, to gain access to the Wi-Fi, work from the cafe, work from the club, work from the showers if they should so desire and are really eager, or go and work in any of our other business centres around town. But that's only part of the story. Because all of this is generating information the whole time. It's helping us to form our strategy. So this is about us moving slight focus away from just being purely property management to that of understanding our customers. So really, let's stop to think about the flow of information around our customers rather than just the flow of information around our buildings themselves. And we're quite a data-rich company when you start to think about it, and very hungry for data. So we still have a traditional property management system that tells you this is a building you own, this is the number of units inside it, this is who's letting this space, this is the rent that they're paying, but also what's available at the moment. And obviously that's information that can come into our customer relationship management system and then start to be fed out into the inquiries process. So it can come out to the website to say what is available. It can then say, okay, we've had a viewing, we like an offer letter, and start the negotiation process. But what it can also do is work back in the other way. Obviously, occupancy is good, places, properties are in demand, so the particular unit that someone may be interested in may not currently be available. So that inquiry goes back to CRM, queries the property management system, and then informs the inquiries and lettings teams, or indeed the prospect, about a unit as and when it becomes available. Of course, there's other activities that are going on in the building. So every time someone goes to fob into a building during day hours access, or indeed using our biometric system, fingerprint recognition out of hours, that's all putting information into the CRM. And where it starts to get really interesting is when we start to think about what is that amount of information that we can then start to see as a result of the Wi-Fi system. So again, if we go back to the metal box, actually 149 leases in place there, old school, how we might talk about our customers. In terms of how many people are actually on the Wi-Fi network, it's 2,050. So plenty of information about the property, about processes, about people and activities. And of course, the customer wants to be self-serving, wants to tell us what their business does, wants to tell us who they want to give access to, both in hours and out of hours, and see their billing. And so there's a self-service customer portal as well. And of course, this has enabled us to start to prove some initiatives as well. So club workspace, meeting rooms, as the systems that we see today, all started within the CRM's functionality. And if we start to think about, if we do 100 plus lettings a month, within the meeting room system, it wouldn't be unusual for us to see up to sort of 1,500 transactions happening a month. If the churn in the normal core portfolio is circa 20%, the churn of club workspace is 125%. Meeting rooms club, small part of our business, small part of our floor space, very valuable to us from our R&D, which is happening all in this section here, but also in streamlining our processes because we don't want to be our credit controllers dealing on that sort of level of income. But then, of course, it then gets us thinking about all the other new initiatives we can start to look at. We'll hear a little bit about comms as we come onto it and how we can see the flow of people through the space. But also we can think about quite simple things like how do we start to offer cleaning services, in-unit cleaning services to our customers? How do we start to link big data into this as well? So in practice, what does this really mean? And this is just a flow of information. This is all those data sets being picked up and linked to create a process. So obviously we start with an account that could be a lease originating in place. It could be someone starting a club membership, which then comes around to how do they get into the building? Are we going to allow them to come into the building? So here this could be, again, through your fob, your biometrics, depending on the time of day. It could be your club card. It could be a code to get into the meeting room. Then comes around and recognises who you are and recognises the access or the level of access to the Wi-Fi infrastructure you can have. Of course, the finance systems are recognising all the monies here. And on top of that, we're building a dashboard, pulling out all those key KPIs and information that helps us to shape the business going forward. So we want to make our customer experience as smooth and as rich, enriched as possible, and encourage them to stay with Workspace and also to start their future businesses with Workspace. And so we've talked through all those different touch points that we have within the portfolio and how that's put into our database, door access, Wi-Fi, etc. But this is now starting to build a really valuable data set for us. Again, if we start to think about the Metal Box Factory, 149 customers, well over 2,000 individuals registered, live individuals registered. It's an extremely powerful piece of information, live information. And so then we can start to think about, well, how do we actually communicate with this big, big customer base? So we can start to do some quite clever things. Again, it's about building that lifestyle or that working style that you have when you're with Workspace. For example, what's the special for lunch today in the cafe? Or what event's happening in the portfolio tonight? Or what particular bean, what's the bean of the week in the coffee machine? Or who's the newest neighbour that you might want to be introduced to? Then through to much more functional things, such as who do you want to have access to your space 24 hours a day? Who do you want to have access to your space during working hours? And are there any abnormalities in terms of the data flows that we can see that are going out from your business when using the data? And of course, all this information's at our fingertips, but also at our customers. And we can start to understand the number of people that are in our business spaces every single day. And of course, this can all be done from our existing mobile web, our responsive web platform. And so really, fundamentally, we've constantly spoken to you previously about having 4,000 customers or 4,000 businesses renting space from us. But in reality, we're now wanting to talk and able to talk to a far greater community. And so if we want to think about how do we start to analyse some of this data. So this is a floor plate, actually, not one of our buildings, but what this is doing is looking at mobile devices moving round a space. So with our Wi-Fi network, which is with the AeroHive.11 platform, we can start to see not only how our customers, gives it our customers freedom to move around, but fundamentally how are those movements happening. We don't know who these individuals are, it's all anonymous, but we do know what is happening. So then we can start to think about, okay, simple things. What sort of finishes does that mean we need in these spaces? Do we need the same level of finish on every single floor? How hard wearing the floor is?
What's the reception going to be like? What's the cafe going to be like? The club workspace is quite interesting. Where are we going to put it? In the past, it was in the basement, if you've ever been to Clerkenwell and seen the one there. Now it's in the shop front window, if you've been to print rooms and our more later offerings. It's adding a vibrancy to our centres. What style of club do we use? We've got 2, 3, 4 wall clubs. I'll come back to that. And what size and what type of co-working do we offer in those clubs? We also need to think about where the meeting rooms are, where the community spaces and the event space. Events are so important now in developing communities in our buildings. The technology. Where's the comms room going to go? We need access to that comms room 6 months before the building's complete. The pipes. Which side of the building are we actually going to feed the pipes into? Can we avoid digging up a main road? The mobile reception. BREEAM compliant windows are great, but they have a metallic micro layer embedded in them. You can see through it, but it stops mobile signals. Where are the boosters going to go? How are we going to make sure that people in that building can still receive mobile calls? And so these components and configurations all need to be thought through at the beginning of the project, not at the end. And all of our refurbishments result in higher quality customer environment and also a higher quality of churn, higher level of churn, sorry, as we obtain vacant possession. Mozilla here is a recognised brand, but actually most of our new customers are not. And they're not easy to identify in advance, but we still need to cater for their needs. So therefore, we rely really heavily on a variety of sources of information about the requirements of our customer base. Inquiries. We get 15,000 inquiries a year. What sort of space are people looking for? Lettings. 1,500 lettings a year, all done in-house. It gives really valuable price elasticity data across London. Our centre managers are in direct contact with the customers, and they also conduct local competitor surveys, so we know what's going on in the local area. We have our customer satisfaction surveys, and we have our CRM systems that James was referring to earlier. the access points, the Wi-Fi, the data consumption. It's valuable information about work patterns. And Mozilla are a good example of the high demands which our customers place on us. And you need to think, none of our building projects benefit from pre-lets. So we've had to build an intelligence-led speculative development approach to apply to our buildings to ensure that we actually they achieve their objectives.
So once we've got to the point where we've defined what it is we want to build, we've identified the opportunity, we really need to start looking at the costs and managing those costs. So as I say, we've got a number of these projects always moving through the system, moving through the production line at the same time. But every year we need to take a pretty close look at how much we're committing to planning risk. So we carry out very early viability assessments on our vision so that we know really the minimum development that we need to get in order to make the project viable. Now, occasionally we get a bit of pushback from the planners, and that gives us the ability to actually stop. Remember, we're keeping the income flowing throughout this entire process, and we can sometimes come back in a couple of years' time and revisit those projects. And what we find is that the whole of the planning system and the planning process is actually moving very much in our favour. And indeed, the government white paper on housing that was published very recently, although it was a heavily watered-down version of what it really should have been, and it was a bit insipid, but there's been a number of things in there which actually have been very helpful to us on our redevelopment programme in the future. So really, this is all about keeping our risks low, managing our cash flow during this period of time, and maintaining income from inception. Once we know exactly what it is we want to do, and we've got this kind of minimum framework which we need to get, we go through the planning process. Now, I think we're pretty unusual. We've got a very, very good story, and we're very well known at quite senior level in a lot of London boroughs because we've been able to demonstrate very clearly that where we develop, regeneration takes place around us, and there's a great deal of really genuine local employment. So quite often, when we're looking at a big scheme, the first port of call will actually be the leader of the council or the economic development officer. And we've quite regularly taken these people from all sorts of boroughs on trips to other sites to sell our concept and our case for policy change. Now, it's not just getting them to buy into it, of course. We have to get the GLA to buy in. Quite regularly, we have to get the local MP and, of course, the other councillors. And really, it's only at this stage that we do start to engage with the planning officers. But the beauty of this is that by the time we've got to this point, we're dealing with the detail, not the principle. And that makes life an awful lot easier. But then, of course, we do have the general public. There are other stakeholders involved. Here is a little meeting, a public meeting we're having on the Rainbow Industrial Estate. It's not always as calm and civilised as you see here. But clearly the principle is that we have advocacy on many levels and, of course, across the 14 or 15 London boroughs in which we operate. And, of course, right at the very top of the tree, the GLA. Once we've got planning consent, we can really start getting stuck into really appraising how it's going to look like. We know exactly what it is we're going to build at this stage. So we've, again, got a go, no-go point at this stage if we wish to have it. Now, our minimum investment target is a 5-year, 10% IRR on an ungeared basis. So that's really the minimum that we're looking at in all of our projects. And if this can be achieved, and we feel confident that it can, obviously we will then go ahead and we will actually serve those notices on our customers in order to obtain vacant possession. Now, this is a project that we've actually just got vacant possession on. This is Cramer Street. It's right opposite Hoxton Station, so it's a fantastic location for us, right in the right place. We're going to convert this into a new business centre, and as you can see, it was light industrial. But the beauty of it was we knew we were in control. So by the time we've got through to this stage, all of our customers are on this six-month notice. So we will go and obviously talk to them, we'll speak to them, we'll serve the 6-month notice, and a very large number of them will really stay there right till the very last knockings. So we can, even in this 6-month period, the actual fall off in rent is actually surprisingly small. And during this 6-month period, of course, what we also do is we get our professional team to design the building down to the last nut and bolt. We can go out to tender, we can get tender prices back, and we can serve all those other bits and pieces, statutory notices, rights of light notices, party wall awards. We can get all of those sorted in the 6-month period. So when the building is vacant, we can move straight on to an enabling works contract. Now, we like to control the enabling works, and this is a pre-contract situation. Because of the nature of our buildings and their age, we're never entirely sure what's in above the ceiling or underneath in the ground. And so to reduce this risk, we always carry out an enabling works contract. So on the left here, this is the Faircharm in Deptford Creek. And this is a big redevelopment project. But what we did was we stripped everything out. So we took out, it was an old carburetor factory, so there were all sorts of nasties in there. So we stripped out all the lead, all the asbestos, all the things that had a very high level of risk associated with them. So that we, when we came to choose our redevelopment partner, in this case it was London and Quadrant, they were able to give us a very best price because they weren't pricing in any risk for what they may find in the building. And similarly, on our refurbishment projects, and this is the frames in Shoreditch, we cleared the site, we took all the contaminants out of the site, and actually at the front here, you just see a little archaeological dig going on. So the key thing is we took all of that risk out of the ground so that when we came to tender it, the contractor priced it without a risk premium to get the absolutely keenest tender price that we could. And the other most important thing here, of course, is the main contractor doesn't get delayed and we don't have all those big arguments about claims for extension of time and additional cost. So then we move on to the main contract. Now, each of our projects has an in-house project manager who oversees our contractor for our refurbishments and will also keep an eye on any third-party contractors where we with our redevelopment partner. But it also means that we can keep our customers in place. And this is the Barley Mow extension in Chiswick. So this is the part of the original Barley Mow Centre. So in that building, virtually all of the customers stayed in place. And we had a fantastic liaison between our customers, our centre management staff, our project manager and the contractor. So it means that we can keep income running within an existing building by keeping this dialogue going. The other reason I wanted to show this was because when we talk about extensions, people might have a bit of a domestic view of an extension. But this is 20,000 square feet over 5 floors. And we're adding that 20,000 square feet to an existing 54,000 square foot building. So it's a very, very significant increase in size. And it's not just the additional space we're creating, but when we do this, we reposition the existing building. So we put in our new thinking about the entrance hall, the cafe, the club workspace, the meeting rooms, the bike store, the showers. And of course, we build in all that new technology that Chris has been talking about. So as we get towards the end of the construction project, obviously we start to bring in our lettings and marketing team. And Chris will just talk you through the process.
So the building's literally taking shape now, and we need to focus specifically on the interiors, on the design details. The size and mix of units. Angus will have designed in flexibility. We can chop and change to quite a late stage of the whole process as we get information about the market. The technology, we can now step in and do those mobile reception surveys and find out what's going on and figure out what we need to do to ensure that a service is available. Cycle storage rooms, reception, the look and feel. We need the staff to be visible to our customers, but we need them to have a professional working environment. This slide actually is Canterbury Court, and it shows you the co-working. So there's not just one type of co-working. We have our main sort of breakout space. We have our club workspace, and we have team rooms. So in the here, for example, you hire that desk, it's yours for the month, you pay for that. In here, you'll go in there and grab whatever space there is. You've all got the same Wi-Fi and the same facilities. These are team rooms, you take them for a month. So it's different types of co-working all within the envelope of the centre. And 2 or 3 years ago, we would never have done this. And a year before that, we would never have done what we'd have done 2 or 3 years ago. It's evolving all the time. So we're able, at this stage of the project, to start thinking about the detail of what we know works and what we think would work best for this building. And in fact, at the print rooms, which we opened about a year ago, we were redesigning the club right up until the last minute. In fact, we moved it from a two-wall club to a three-wall club to give it better separation from the cafe. The cafe itself, we need to negotiate terms with an operator. We need to work out with them what the look and feel's like, who buys the furniture, do we, do they, how do all the fixtures and fittings work. Security. What style of security system do we want? How many access points are there to the building? We then need to sit down with our security partners, Chubb, and design a detailed security system for that building so that everyone's safe and we can control what's going on in that building from day one. So it's a wide company effort and there's a lot to do. But our marketing team then brings its considerable expertise to drive inquiries. And we have three phases. Pre-launch, we're able to show virtual reality tours based on CGIs. We also can work on the website. Is the dot on the map? Can we spotlight the building? This is a good example. This is our spotlighting record hall opening in April on our website. So you get a feel when you go onto our website for what's going on. And we try and book viewings as early as possible. So in the last few weeks at Record Hall, we've had 112 inquiries and 31 viewings. So the marketing is already generating interest. At the launch, the online advertising clicks in, the PPC, the social media, the centre gets its own Twitter handle, and we start to generate a lot more online activity. Email footers, every email that goes out from a workspace colleague has a footer on it that will highlight the centre. So again, we're pushing out the messaging, that centre's launched. Post-launch, of course, we can then do Google 360 tours so you can get an actual feel for what it looks like. Launch events, community and networking events. And the important point is we can collate feedback. We collect feedback from every viewing. So we're getting market intelligence as early as possible to help the letting team when they start to negotiate. So the lettings team is focused on deals and pricing. The asset management team is focused on value and profit. Now, with new centres, they carry a service charge, and a high proportion of that service charge is fixed from day one. So getting the balance right between bringing in immediate revenue and driving pricing is quite a challenge for us. And it's much easier to drive pricing in a full building than it is to drive pricing in a vacant building or an empty building. But first of all, you have to get the basics right. We have to measure the units to verify their size. You can't really rely on design drawings. You'll get caught out at some point. We need to select the most appropriate lease terms. And we're finding that two-year leases provide a really good opportunity to start to drive pricing and ERV and value at a relatively early stage in the life of a building. And as you can see on the slide, there's a lot of detail that we need to share internally. We have a base price. You're not allowed to let at below the base price without approval. And you have a bonus if you can get us above the asking price. So this is a really intensive phase of activity, and we monitor what's going on very aggressively. We change things very, very regularly because we need to drive revenue and pricing as hard as we possibly can.
The key thing is to learn how we can do things better. And so what we really are trying to do all the time is to make sure that every new building that we deliver is just that little bit better than the last one. And of course, we do that by getting the feedback from our customers throughout all of our in-house team, and we build that into our project. And just going back and just emphasising one thing that Chris was talking about, you know, we do make sure that when we deliver a new building to the market, it's perhaps our thinking of 2 months ago, Whereas a lot of people, when they deliver a new building to the market, it's their thinking of 2 years ago. So our thinking is progressing all the time. But of course, it's not just making sure that our buildings are great, it's also making sure that our bottom line works. And so we look at these graphs every Monday morning. We go through these. So this looks at our total rent roll in the building compared to what we'd planned and our total occupancy. This is Grand Union Studios. And I think it's fair to say that on every single project that we've run, we really have consistently exceeded our 10% ungeared five-year IRR. So that really wraps up how the process works from start to finish. But I think it's important also to show that we've got a very good pipeline of projects coming through. And Jamie showed you this chart at the half-year results in November. It's moved on a little bit since then, obviously, as things progress. But the key is that all of these projects are within our control. We own the freehold of all of these sites. And there's a continual supply of new space to improve our services to our customers. I think really the final point I want to make is just really how closely we all work together. This is very much a team effort, and taking constant feedback from our customers to improve our offer as we go through. But it's nice to see that it's not just our customers who appreciate our approach. It's also our peer group and other parties. And this is just a list of some of the accolades we've received over the last couple of years. So we're very proud of this, actually, in all fairness. So I think at that point, I just want to really hand back to Jamie, and we'll take it from there.
Perfect timing, I think.
Thank you, everybody. I really appreciate all the effort that presenters have made, and Michael, thanks a lot for joining us as well. Lots of information, hopefully some of it useful. Three key messages that I would love you to take away. Firstly, how technology has and will continue to have a big impact on the real estate industry. How Workspace is harnessing technology across both our customers and also our own business. And how, as a landlord, we embrace the future, not shy away from it, make confident, well-informed, future-proof decisions when bringing new space to the market. And I mean, there's a lot of information today, but if that's all you can take away for today, then hopefully there's been some stuff in here that's been useful. Now, you can't have a capital markets day without looking at a new property, which I'm sure is going to divert all course from quick Q&A, but we'd love you to ask a few questions on technology. Now, most of you will have noticed we bought a building on Friday, quite fresh slide, so I'm probably just going to give you lots and lots of stats, but by all means ask me anything you need to. And I know that there was some link with some of the announcements that Derwent made this morning, which if you haven't quite connected how it all works, then I can explain that to you as well, hopefully, without stepping over things I'm not allowed to say. This is the building we bought, BT Tower, not the BT Tower, the building next to the BT Tower. 92,700 square feet, owned by Arup, and we bought it from Arup. And the reason I emphasise that is not that I'm making any criticism of Arup, but obviously they're not a traditional landlord. We bought this off the market, and they are leasing it back roughly for 3.5 years at £52.50. If they stay, which we don't think they will, because obviously they're committing now to Derwent Saatchi and Saatchi building, their rent will go up to £65. So we're pretty comfortable with that deal. But the plan for us is to see them leave probably 3.5 years' time. We paid £98.5 million, which is 4.6% net initial yield. So that'll sit there for the next couple of years. We think there's great opportunity to actually extend the site. We haven't factored any of that in, but there's some very obvious fill-ins on the top of the building. So whether we would like more space there or not is in debate, but there's an opportunity there. The building is lower ground, 6 floors. Great natural light all the way through. There's an atrium, which you'll see on a floor plan in the middle in a minute. Jumping around, you probably know the location very well. Charlotte Street, you've got Warren Street Tube Station, Good Street Tube Station, Tottenham Court Road, where the new Crossrail station is going in. I'm not going to go on about that because I know you all know about it. Obviously, Toby's and Great Portland's Facebook letting down here and the stuff that Derwent are doing, you'll see in a minute. So that's the site. I don't know if you saw this morning, did you? Did they put a site plan forward? Someone told me their technology broke down. This, no pun intended. BT Tower, that's the building we bought. That's the building that Arup bought from Derwent, which is let on a long lease, 2033 fixed increases, I think they paid £197 million for what they said this morning. And that is the building that Derwent are redeveloping, which Arup are taking space in, just to give you the context. So they are all absolutely linked. We think this is hugely exciting for us. Nothing like our offer around here. We know the area very, very well. We've been trying to find somewhere around here. It's quite an exciting, creative location. We think it's only going to get better. And obviously, with everything that's going around here, along with the Middlesex Hospital development, which is kind of down here, there's quite a lot to talk about. The floor plates for this building work absolutely perfectly for us. In fact, they don't really work for a single occupier, which is one of the reasons I think Arup probably said that was why their move. You've got the entrance, you've got a central atrium, so you've got light on all sides of the building. And then we've actually done indicative floor plans here for how it might work for us. We think we'll probably get 90 to 100 units here, but again, as we've talked about, depending on the mood of the moment and what we think the market will demand, it'll depend on how we break the floors up. But you can see good natural light, floor-to-ceiling windows, which we always quite like. So I think for us, great property, great pricing, great opportunity. It'd be nice to get our hands on it sooner, but actually waiting for the opportunity of £52.50 is very comfortable for us, especially with all the other development that's going on around the area.